Mr. Sharpen has told me that we're running just a little bit late, so that I need to keep this as brief as possible. So in conclusion, you know, I received my master's degree from Youngstown State University, YSU, or as we affectionately call it, Yucky U. It really has a very good history department, so I was really privileged to be able to attend there. And the reason that I'm here today is that we have a very enthusiastic deacon in the local church who, he's a real doer, a real go-getter. And he read my thesis and really loved it, and so he made arrangements for me to speak here. And then just appreciate it so much, he finally told me about it, of course, after he made the arrangements. So I was able to put this together, and it does follow my thesis somewhat, although abbreviated form. Thesis is available. I think I saw one copy back in the room if you'd like to take a look at it. I don't know. I think you can purchase it, or if they want to make other copies of it. I think they're selling it for whatever it costs them to copy it. So brethren in the local church area arranged for me to be here, and I really appreciate that. But the speakers that preceded me make it really a tough act to follow, especially Mr. Rose, who covered some of the material that I'm going to cover, although I'm going to look at it from a somewhat different perspective. And history is that way. History is not something that's cut and dried. People tell me, boy, history is it's boring. History isn't boring. History is simply news that has already been written. We're just reading news of the past when we're reading history. So I noticed a couple of things that I am a panel somehow or another. I thought I was. I don't know how one person can be a panel, but then I figured it out. Panels doesn't mean me. It means these panels they just put up here. So you know, we are all products of history. To a great degree, the way we act, talk, or even think depends on the circumstances that shaped us. That is, we're the product of all the generations that have preceded us and shaped our culture. Mr. Rose spoke about culture just a few moments ago. For the most part, that culture, and in America today, there are many cultures, possibly every one of us in this room are from a slightly different cultural background. So America has many cultures today, and that's been defined. Our culture in this country, even though it is diverse, has been defined usually by the movers and shakers of a society, the Washingtons and Jeffersons, the Edisons and Einsteins. But it is also heavily influenced by the nameless multitudes who have labored and struggled to simply make it through life. And that's probably like most of us here today. Occasionally, one of those comparatively insignificant individuals does something that lifts the shroud of obscurity from his shoulders and thrusts him into a prominence that he may not have expected or even wanted. Stephen Mumford was one of those individuals, for he emerged from anonymity. Let me try that. Sometimes I get my tongue wrapped around my eye teeth and I can't see what I'm saying. So Stephen Mumford emerged from anonymity to bring Christian Seventh-day Sabbath observance to North America and then just quietly fade from the scene. When I began my research on this particular subject, I had hoped that I could develop something about Stephen Mumford, the man, and I found that information very, very scant. So many Sabbath observers today maintain that Christians have observed the Sabbath without interruption from the days of the apostles. Some who do not keep the Sabbath plainly state that Sunday observance rests, has been discussed already here today, rests primarily on one point, and that's the Sunday morning resurrection of Jesus Christ. Yet Henry Clark in the 19th century and Herbert W. Armstrong in the 20th claim Christ was crucified and buried on a Wednesday, was in the grave Thursday, which would have been the annual Passover Sabbath, Friday, and most of Saturday, and resurrected near sunset on the Sabbath. History reveals that many early Christians observed the Sabbath, while others observed Sunday. And Dr. Bakayoki has eloquently addressed that issue earlier. but some observed both days. Clearly, a division concerning the day of worship began at an early date and continued into the generations following the death of the original apostles. For example, in the early 2nd century, Polycarp, bishop of Smyrna, confronted Anicetus, bishop of Rome, with the claim that Christians should keep Passover on Nisan 14th rather than Easter, which was observed in the Western Church. He claimed the apostle John instructed him in this practice. In the late 2nd century, this controversy appeared again when Polycrates met with the Roman bishop Victor I, who threatened to excommunicate all the churches of the East. So clearly this was not a matter of simply one man in opposition to another, but it involved whole regions. So it's difficult to conceive how this Old Testament practice of Passover observance, which has already been said was called the Quartadeciman controversy, how that practice would have been observed unless other Old Testament practices, such as a Sabbath, had also been observed at that time. But after the time of Constantine, these issues ceased to play a prominent role. Not that they went into absolute obscurity and didn't happen anymore, but they ceased to play a prominent role until the Protestant Reformation. Yet the Sabbath, at least, was not unknown during those years, between the time of Constantine and the Protestant Reformation, because Columba, in the late 6th century, for example, he said, or is supposed to have foretold his death on a Saturday with these words, quote, "This day is called the Sabbath, that is, the day of rest, and such it will truly be for me, for it will put an end to my labors." Yet it's unlikely he ever observed the Sabbath, because he kept Mass on the first day of the week, on Sunday. During the following centuries, numerous groups observed practices that did not conform to Roman Catholic traditions. And of course, these people have gone down in history as heretics. These Christians include the Paulicians in the 6th century, the Petrobrusians and the Bogomils in the 12th. And of course, perhaps best known are the Waldenses, led by Peter of Lyon, better known as Peter Waldo. Now, my research has indicated that Peter Waldo may not have begun the Waldensian movement, but rather, because his name was Peter of Lyon, he lived in Lyon, and so that was his name. He became known as Peter Waldo because he associated himself then with the Waldenses. And as a result, he became Peter Waldo. People think that he started that organization, but Peter Alex, writing, I think, in the 16th or 17th century, indicates there's from sources that were available then that may not be extant right now, that he simply came along after the Waldenses had been firmly established. So Sabbatarians claim that Sabbath keepers can be found among the Waldenses, although it's difficult to establish that, in fact, not just the Waldenses, but some of these other groups. But it is difficult to establish that their most prominent leaders observed the Sabbath. There's no record, for example, that clearly says Peter Waldo ever kept the Sabbath, but there may have been Sabbath observers among them. On October 31st, 1517, Martin Luther then nailed his 95 theses to the castle church door of Wittenberg and began a chain of events that made it possible for nonconformists, or quote-unquote heretics, to emerge from the obscurity of the earlier years. What Luther began became known as the Magisterial Reformation because it merely shifted religious authority from pope and priest to king and prince. That is, when the king adopted Lutheranism, the nation became Lutheran. If the king adopted Catholicism, the nation was Catholic. It didn't have anything to do with personal conviction. It was magisterial in origin. So it merely shifted from authority in Rome to national authority. Soon, however, this Reformation took a dramatic turn. In Switzerland, Ulrich Zwingli urged his followers to rely neither on pope nor king, but on the scriptures alone to determine Christian doctrine, beginning what has been called then the Radical Reformation, because it departed radically from the authority and the grinding heel of the papacy and of the magistrates, the kings. So one of the most prominent movements to come out of this particular period then of the Radical Reformation was that of the Anabaptists. They began on January 21st, 1525, when Conrad Grebel baptized George Blaurock, a former priest, at the home of a man named Felix Manz, M-A-N-Z. Their followers then, the Anabaptists, believed that only those capable of making sound judgment could receive what they called believer's baptism. And they maintained that infant baptism was useless because children were simply not old enough to believe the teachings of the Bible. Their enemies then gave them their name because they insisted, that is, the Anabaptists insisted that infant baptism was invalid. Thus, they were anti-Baptists. They were against the baptism of the church. They were not against baptism, however. Many Anabaptists later became known simply as Baptists. In England during this time, Henry VIII wrested control of the English church from the authority of Rome. Yet, for the most part, he maintained traditional Catholic doctrines, except in regard to the supremacy of the Pope, and he would brook no heresy. In other words, it was Catholicism without the Pope. Henry supplanted the Pope. However, Henry's cohorts in this were devoted Protestants, but he would not permit their influence to be felt except in a few minor things. Relatively minor things. But after Henry's death, England plunged into full-fledged Protestantism during the reign of the boy king, which is Edward VI, who ascended the throne when he was only 9 years old and died of pulmonary tuberculosis when he was only 15. Now, the fact that he was a boy king made it possible for his counselors to manipulate things in such a way that they could introduce a more strongly Protestant religion to the country. But that doesn't mean that Edward himself was not a devoted Protestant. He was. And he argued with his half-sister, Mary, who would later succeed him and become Bloody Mary, the Queen Mary of England. He argued with her over the issue of whether one should be Protestant or Catholic. So when Mary then, Bloody Queen Mary, ascended the throne, she persecuted the Protestants and returned England to the Catholic fold. As a result, many Protestants had to flee to the continent where John Calvin was active at Geneva, and they picked up much more of their training at this point, at this very crucial point in history. So after then, Mary died. She was succeeded by Elizabeth I, who turned the country back towards Protestantism. Now, all of these who had fled England could come back. And so, England became a Protestant nation once again. Picture this, all in a generation, all in less than a generation. It was a dramatic and a traumatic experience for the English people. For many Protestants, especially the Puritans, however, the Protestant movement in England didn't go far enough. Elizabeth compromised too much. To the Catholics, however, she was an uncompromising heretic. So there was a great deal of conflict in England at the time. Elizabeth ruled for many, many years. They're not sure how long. I think most scholars believe that it was probably about 42 years. That's a long time. She was succeeded by James VI of Scotland, who then became James I of England, when Elizabeth died unmarried and childless. Now, it was James I then who authorized the King James Version of the Bible. Still, religious strife continued in England right up to the birth of Stephen Mumford and beyond. When studying Christian Sabbath observers, Mumford's name comes up again and again. Yet it is easier to find the effects of his presence than it is to get a clear picture of the man himself. Born in England, probably London, in 1639, he lived through some of the most tumultuous times that nation ever saw. Shortly after his birth, from 1642 to 1646, the English Civil War raged, And although he was too young to remember much about it, he still had to have fully experienced its effect. He lived in a land that went from monarchy to protectorate under Lord Protector Oliver Cromwell, and then back again in only a few short years as the battle for religious supremacy ripped the country apart. By the time Mumford had grown to adulthood, the monarchy had been restored. Never mind that King Charles I had been beheaded. And 5 years later, in 1665, Mumford sailed for the New World with his wife Anne. For many years, it was thought that he had been a member of the Sabbath-observing Bell Lane Church in London, because John Comer, writing in 1730, said Mumford and his wife were members of a Seventh-day Church in England. More recently, however, Oscar Burdick of the Graduate Theological Union Seminary, Union Library in Berkeley, California, discovered the Mumford's name on the roll of the Tewksbury Baptist Church. And so it wasn't a Seventh-day, it wasn't a Sabbath-keeping church at all. It was just a Baptist church. Probably they would have been called Anabaptists at that time. They may have, at that time, attended that church and observed the Sabbath privately. When Parliament then enacted the series of statutes that culminated in the Act of Uniformity of 1662, nonconformists like Stephen Mumford and the Baptists that he fellowshipped with lived under the constant threat of persecution. If authorities discovered the identity of one of these dissenters, or they called them recusants, that particular individual could be imprisoned, tortured, or even put to death. And imprisonment usually was a virtual death sentence because the authorities provided no food. If you ate, it was only because your friends and family brought you food. Otherwise, they just let you starve to death in a vermin-infested and filthy cell. So being charged with heresy, being charged with recusancy, was not really something that anyone would want to have brought against them. So they needed some protection. And to protect them, members of dissenting congregations often kept their records in code. And this is where Oscar Burdick discovered the Mumford's name. It was in code. And I have a copy, a Xerox copy, of that particular document in my thesis. So if the journal that those records were kept in were taken by government officials, it would take them time to decipher it and give the members a chance to escape. They'd be able to get away if they so chose. Mumford and his co-religionists, therefore, lived under this constant threat of discovery. Then another crisis arose. Beginning in the spring of 1665, a great plague ravaged London. At its height, more than 7,000 people died in a single week. Now, London, of course, wasn't as big as it is today, so 7,000 was a lot of people. In that year, the Mumfords sailed for England's American colonies and escaped the plague as well as the religious persecution that gripped the country. When they arrived in Rhode Island, they began attending the Baptist Church in Newport. By this time, Mumford was 26 years old and had still done nothing to indicate the historical impact that he would later have. Certainly little is known about him up to that time, but that was all about to change. He would eventually begin a series of events that would lead to the formal establishment of Seventh-day Sabbath observance in North America. Before he could do that, however, the ground had to be prepared to receive the seed of the Sabbath that he would sow. Roger Williams, a minister from England, provided that preparation. Williams arrived in Nantasket in the winter of 1631 and served as a pastor in Plymouth and Salem, Massachusetts. He was a devout Puritan and Calvinist, and he believed secular authorities should not interfere in matters of religious conscience. That went totally against the flow of things that day. This was very unpopular among the authorities of the time. And it eventually led to his banishment from Massachusetts. And as a result, he fled to Rhode Island, where he purchased land from the Narragansett Indians and established then the first Baptist church on the American continent. It was this church, the Mumfords, attended when they arrived at the colony, because there were no Sabbath keepers here. And as a result, you see, they went from the Baptist Church at Tewksbury in England to the Baptist Church in Rhode Island in England's American colonies. Having experienced persecution of nonconformists, that is, these Baptists were nonconformists and they themselves had experienced a great deal of persecution. Obadiah Holmes, for example, who was a member of this church and who figures prominently in the dispute that will come about as a result of Sabbath observance there, Obadiah Holmes had suffered imprisonment and even beatings because he simply was not active as a member of the Church of England. He was a Baptist. So since they experienced this kind of persecution, members of the Newport Baptist Church did not object to the Mumfords observing the Sabbath privately each week. Even after several others joined them in the practice, no one raised a complaint. But by 1671, four of these individuals, a man named Nicholas Wilde and his wife, and another man named John Salmon and his wife, stopped observing the Sabbath. And those who continued to keep it wrote to the Bell Lane Church in London for advice on how to deal with the situation, and this is where the difficulties began. Edward Stennett replied from London. He said that they must not, quote now, take pleasure in them, that is the members who had ceased to keep the Sabbath, but must withdraw yourselves from them as sinful and disorderly persons. And if the church hold communion with those apostates from the truth, you ought then to desire to be fairly dismissed from the church. Unquote. In June of 1671, Obadiah Holmes, who I just mentioned, delivered a sermon criticizing the Sabbatarians for calling these four form of Sabbath keepers apostates. As a result, on July 12th of that year, Mumford and those with him refused to take communion with the rest of the members of the church. The following Sunday, they were asked to give an account for their actions. But it was not Mumford who replied, but a man named William Hiscox. Now, Mumford, from this point on, did not play a very significant role in the Sabbath. I could find very little literature on him. Other people did. So Hiscox said that the elders of the church had denied the Ten Commandments were moral rules for the Gentiles and upheld the actions of the backsliders, as he called them. He charged Holmes with false speaking publicly because he had said that some had left Christian precepts to go to, as he said, Moses in the observation of days, which means the Sabbath. And that his public preaching then was, at least to the Sabbatarians, offensive. John Clark, the pastor of the church, denied the charges, saying he had personally said the Ten Commandments were in fact moral rules. The contention grew more heated. And I have it fully outlined in my thesis, if you want to take a look at that. As it grew more heated, finally one of the members, a man named Joseph Torrey, suggested that the Sabbatarians separate themselves from the Baptist church, and Hiscox agreed. By December 7th, 1671, Mumford and the others formed their own church in Hopkinton with Hiscox as pastor. At this time, the group of Sabbatarians consisted of only about seven people, the Mumfords, the Hiscoxes, the Samuel Hubbards, who later played a much more prominent role in the Sabbath movement than what Stephen Mumford did, Roger Baster and Rachel Langworth, and of course their families, but remember they believed in believers' baptism, so only those seven were members. Their families weren't counted as members, but simply as part of their families. So when the Baptist leaders in Boston, heard of the conflict in Newport, they sent a letter to the Sabbath keepers. It read like this, in part, quote, "And although we dare not judge your consciences in the observation of a day or days to the Lord, yet, brethren, you're judging them that have so done, and we hope have not unadvisedly changed their minds, to be apostates seems to our understandings to savor too much of a censorious spirit." I felt that was a tactful criticism. You know, so often we tend to be judgmental as human beings, and we've often, even among Sabbath keepers, we've judged others. And that perhaps is not something that we ought to be doing. The specific role that Mumford played during this period of time is not really known. He sat mute as Hiscox spoke for the group. So it is we see little of his actions, but much of the effects of his presence. Because if he hadn't been there in the first place, perhaps none of this would have happened. 4 years later, with the Sabbatarian Church established with Hiscox as pastor, Mumford left for London in January of 1675, perhaps with a hope of bringing additional Sabbath keepers back with him. He sailed from Boston and reached London about 6 weeks later. And then he met with some Sabbath keepers and then wrote home about them. He said, and I quote, "I was received by the brethren with much joy, in some of them who had a great desire to hear of our place and people. Some of them talk of coming with me. However, when he returned to the colonies that October, he brought with him only William Gibson and his wife. When Hiscox died in 1704, Gibson succeeded him as pastor. Mumford's wife, Anne, died February 22nd, 1697. That's old style. For those of you who aren't familiar with old style and new style, it's simply that they used to recognize the beginning of the year, I think, in March or April. And then later they recognized it, as we do today, in January. And so old style would have taken in that period there. And there have been other calendar changes, too, but this is what this particular part was referring to. And Anne's husband then, Stephen Mumford, died then in July 1707. They had three children, and none of these apparently continued to observe the Sabbath. Their oldest, also named Stephen, became a merchant. There's a curious aside on this. When I went to do some of my research there in Newport, the man who was in charge of the archives there said, "Oh, you know, some Sabbath observers think Stephen Mumford was a minister." He wasn't. He was a sea captain. The sea captain was Stephen Mumford's son. So they didn't have it quite right either. His second son was named John, and he had been appointed by Rhode Island's Assembly to survey land for settlement. And their only daughter, Anne, died at the age of 26, unmarried. As a result, Mumford's legacy was not with his family, with his physical family, but rather with the Sabbatarian movement, or you might say with his spiritual family. All during Mumford's life, the group apparently remained too small to have a regular building where they could hold meetings. It was not until the next generation, in 1729, that the Sabbatarians erected a church, which became then just one small part of the legacy of Stephen Mumford. Again, it was done after he was no longer on the scene. Now, this church was constructed under the direction of two men, Jonathan Weedon and Henry Collins. Now, we don't know too much about Jonathan Weedon, but Collins was the son of a woman named Almy or Amy Ward. At the time of his marriage, of Collins' father, that is, at the time of his marriage to her, she was a widow of Thomas Ward and the mother of Richard Ward, who later became a governor of Rhode Island. So without the effect of Mumford's presence then, there would have been no meeting house in Newport, and Sabbath observance in North America could have taken an entirely different course. Certainly it's conceivable that other Sabbath observers had come to the American colonies before the Mumfords. And in my research, people had said that. You can find that written. But there's no clear evidence of that where you can find it. Here somebody settled and you've got a direct line from them that you can trace. You can't do that. You find groups, but you can't connect them very often. So it is that Stephen Mumford, we have to look to him then for the beginning of that thread of continuity in Sabbath observance. His legacy remains intact and uninterrupted today in the Seventh-day Baptist Church, the direct lineal descendant of the original group of Newport Sabbath keepers. Seventh-day Baptists are very sensitive about that. If we were to say Stephen Mumford is the one that began our church, they would bristle at that because he was the one who began their church. And that's just the way they look at it. I picked that particular frame of mind up time and again when I talked with people or wrote to them for information and that sort of thing, was while I was doing my research. But keep in mind that just as many Protestant groups spun off from the Catholic Church and then redivided into many different churches, so it is with other Sabbatarian organizations which developed later. By 1811, Sabbatarians had established churches not only in Rhode Island, but also in New Jersey, Connecticut, Virginia, and New York. These widely scattered groups had developed along more or less democratic congregationalist lines. Each group determined its own qualifications for membership. They appointed their own pastor, and they determined his salary, and each member had a vote in all of these proceedings. Although they became known as Seventh-day Baptists much earlier, these Sabbath keepers did not officially recognize that name until the church's general conference adopted it in 1818. So they had been around a long time before they took the name Seventh-day Baptist officially. In those early days, many doctrinal differences existed among Seventh-day Baptists because they didn't really have a centralized authority. Only the Sabbath bound them together. For example, regarding the Trinity, Henry Clark, writing in 1811, noted that there were, quote, few, if any, of this denomination who believe that the Father, Son, and Holy Ghost are three absolute, distinct persons, unquote. Now, he hedges his bets here because he said few, if any, which indicates some may have. In addition, he associated this doctrine, the doctrine of the Trinity, with the baptizing of infants, which they called pedobaptism. And he felt that that was opposed to believers' baptism. So he didn't agree with the Trinity himself, although he stresses this in such an ambiguous manner that you can't really say for sure. You know, I thought when I started studying history in a more intense way that's necessary when you're looking for graduate work finished, I thought, you know, history is the recording of facts. Nothing could be further from the truth. There's so much conflict among historians. I know Dr. Bakayoki will tell you, they just don't agree among themselves. But once they get an idea, they hang on to it, and you can't wedge it out of them ordinarily. I was really pleased about your mentor who said that he had switched completely. That's a scholar. That's the way it should be. We should be able to take correction, and if we're wrong, change it. So it's really good to hear that there are scholars like that and historians among them. Seventh-day Baptists then have historically attempted to maintain good relations with their communities and with other religious groups. If a first-day church, which they called people who kept Sunday, needed a pastor, the Seventh-day Baptists gladly provided one until the need was filled. At the same time, they also permitted ministers from other denominations to serve as their preachers, sometimes for years. Now, I would think that would have a really negative effect on Sabbath observance. If you have a pastor there for 10 or 15 years, and they did that at times, who wasn't preaching about the Sabbath, how is that going to be something that you can hold on to? It's going to be very difficult. However, by 1853, Seventh-day Baptists could be found in greater numbers than many other religious organizations, including Wesleyan Methodists, Second Adventists, influenced by the preaching of William Miller in the 1830s and 40s, Universalists, and Jews. The first Sabbath-keeping church, then, the first part of the legacy of Stephen Mumford, is the roughly 6,000-member Seventh-day Baptist church. Yet because of its small size, relatively few people are familiar with it. Speak of Christian Sabbath observers to most in today's society, and they immediately think of the much larger Seventh-day Adventist church. And I think they have about 4.5 million people. 8 million now. See what I mean? Historians don't know what they're talking about. Curiously, here too, Stephen Mumford left his mark, though. Adventist doctrines developed through the influences of a number of people, most notably Ellen G. White and William Miller. Now, William Miller was mentioned a little earlier. He taught that Jesus Christ would return in late March or early April 1844, and later set the date for what he called the Second Advent on October 22nd of that year. That date passed uneventfully. An Adventist, and I have to say with a small a here because there was no Seventh-day Adventist church at this time. These were just people who were looking forward to the second advent of Jesus Christ. These Adventists have since then referred to that date where Christ did not return, referred to that date as the Great Disappointment. Now, I thought that Mr. Rose was going to preempt me on some of this, and he did. Shame on him. But we're going to approach this from a somewhat different view here. Among Miller's followers was a young girl named Ellen G. Harmon, who later married a man named James White. And so this became Ellen G. White. In the December following the Great Disappointment, while in prayer with a group of Adventist women, Ellen is reputed to have had the first of some 2,000 visions that came to her during her lifetime. Seventh-day Adventists base many of their doctrines on the teachings of these two individuals. So the question then naturally arises as to whether William Miller ever kept the Sabbath. There is no proof that he did. But 5 years before his death, during the winter of 1843 and 1844, as Mr. Rose mentioned earlier, a group of about 40 Millerites in Washington, New Hampshire, did begin to keep the Sabbath. From there, it was spread by a Methodist circuit rider named Frederick Wheeler. He was their pastor at that time. Now, Wheeler then introduced the Sabbath to Thomas Preble, who later then published this particular belief in a booklet entitled Tract Showing That the Seventh Day Should Be Observed as the Sabbath. No short titles in those days. A former sea captain, Joseph Bates, then picked up that tract and read it, and then he went to the group in Washington to learn more about the practice. Although he doubted Ellen G. White's visions, he told her about the Sabbath in 1846, but she rejected it. Later, however, she claimed God revealed to her in a vision that the Sabbath observance would have preserved the world from idolatry. So she accepted it, and then Bates accepted her visions. But how did the group in Washington learn of the Sabbath? As far as Seventh-day Adventists are concerned, that is where it all began. Once again, we find the influence of Stephen Mumford, a Seventh-day Baptist widow, which Mr. Rose caught me earlier, named Rachel Oaks, or Preston. She moved there from Verona, New York, to Washington, New Hampshire, to be with her daughter, Delight. Isn't that a delightful name? Forget those puns. That's terrible. And Delight had taken a position as a school teacher there in Washington, New Hampshire. Since there was no Sabbath-keeping churches in that area, Rachel Oaks kept it privately, like her predecessor Stephen Mumford, and attended church on Sundays with the small group of Millerite Adventists. During the winter of 1843 and 44, Frederick Wheeler delivered a sermon stressing the necessity to obey the Ten Commandments. Rachel told him, you don't observe them all. When he insisted that he did, she confronted him with the Sabbath command. And as a result of that, then, Frederick Wheeler led most of his small group there of Adventists in observing the Sabbath. He then converted to Sabbath observance at that time or shortly after that. From Wheeler, then, it spread to Preble, and from Preble to Bates, and from Bates, finally, it came to James and Ellen G. White. While Rachel Oaks is responsible for introducing the Sabbath to what would become the Seventh-day Adventist Church, she did not join that organization until shortly before her death. You running me off?
No,
okay. But her influence, and indirectly the influence of Stephen Mumford, did not stop there. She began a series of events that would also lead to the establishment of the much smaller denomination. When Joseph Bates began preaching the Sabbath doctrine in several states, he influenced Gilbert Cranmer in Michigan, who would become instrumental in organizing the Church of God's Seventh Day. Cranmer also went through the Great Disappointment. He learned of the Sabbath in 1844 in an article by J.C. Day in the Midnight Cry, a Millerite publication, although at that time he did not yet begin keeping it. And I want also to add that some of my research included the booklet that Mr. Rose showed you up here. It's excellent. I found it very candid. It addressed the problems that the Seventh-day the Church of God Seventh-day faced during that time in a very candid and refreshing manner. If you don't have a copy of it, I recommend it highly. And I'm not going to say I'm not promoting it. I am. It's a very fine booklet. So after the great disappointment that Gilbert Cranmer went through, he was later confronted with the teachings of Joseph Bates after he had read about it in the Midnight Cry. And after Joseph Bates approached him, then he himself began to observe it. He met James and Ellen White in December of 1857, but disagreed with a number of their doctrines. Most importantly, he refused to believe Mrs. White's visions had any validity. Although Adventists say that he led the smoke and chew party out of the church because he apparently used tobacco, and that was not popular among Adventists at that time. So he refused to accept Ellen G. White's visions, said they were contradictory, and a short time later, he severed his association with them and began a separate organization of his own. Once he broke with the Whites, he established 10 congregations with 8 ministers who allied themselves with him. In 1860, he organized a conference of churches in Michigan. I'm over time. Okay. All right. All right. He organized a conference of churches in Michigan, and by 1863, they had adopted the name Church of Christ. It's possible he drew some of his support from those isolated groups that I told you may have come about apart from the legacy that Stephen Mumford had made, because the Whites had also encountered groups of Sabbath observers and tried to bring them into the Adventist movement. For example, Merritt E. Cornell had by that time established several Sabbath observing churches under the name Church of Jesus Christ, and members of that organization adopted a covenant that set forth their beliefs, which included keeping the commandments of God and, quote, the faith of Jesus, taking the Bible and the Bible alone as a rule for our faith and discipline, unquote. Within a year and a half, though, Cornell tried to bring the followers into the Seventh-day Adventist movement, and this created a great schism in the groups. However, reluctance to have a formal centralized church government appears to have been widespread among these groups. William Miller certainly had none. He had followers in many different denominations. James and Ellen White also had great difficulty in centralizing authority among Seventh-day Adventists. Nevertheless, in 1884, at a meeting in Stanbury, Missouri, Cranmer and the others agreed to press for a general conference of the church with members in other states. By the early 20th century, this association had come together under the name Church of God Seventh Day, but soon division threatened once again. Andrew Duggar wanted to centralize doctrinal policy by forbidding the public preaching of any doctrine not endorsed by the conference body. He also attempted to centralize church finances in order to make more funds available to support activity to increase membership. But rather than strengthening the church, it only served to bring to the surface long-held distrust of centralized authority, and that discontent eventually caused a split. Now, I do have a little more here. I didn't know I was going to be that big a blabbermouth. But eventually, as Mr. Rose pointed out, this group split into the Stanbury faction and the Salem, West Virginia faction and the Oregon faction, where Herbert W. Armstrong began later the Radio Church of God. So the legacy then of Stephen Mumford appears to be one of division, really, in a sense, because he had to divide from the Baptists, he had to separate from the Baptists, and that type of really a Calvinist concept of each man is answering to himself with God, so that each person then determines their own concept of right and wrong, in a sense, although they did rely on the Bible. But it became very controversial through the years. Now, of course, you could mention scores of other Sabbath-observing churches, and they all are a part of the legacy of Stephen Mumford. He came out of a time of great trouble and turmoil, and with his wife, he quietly observed the Sabbath and influenced several people to join him. Yet he does not appear to have been a man of great eloquence or power to persuade. Emerge the churches that have been tried in the same forge. So I guess we can have questions now. We have any questions, or did I cover it perfectly?
Maybe time for one or two questions, and then we have the privilege of Dr. Bakayoki once again.
Yes, can I ask quickly, one of the things that I've researched in looking into the history of the church, Duggard Dodd in his book indicated there's always has been Seventh-day people down through history, from the time of Christ until now, of which we trace our heritage, though formally they have various organizations which we've seen publicly. Have you found that to be supported, or is that speculation?
Some of the groups that we had in the past said were Sabbath-keeping groups were not. But that does not mean that there were not Sabbath keepers in those groups. You can't get a handle on this very easily because the records that are available are not records of the groups themselves for the most part. They're records of their enemies, and you can't really believe them all the time. So it's conceivable that some of these groups had members who did in fact observe the Sabbath. But it's hard, it's something that's really difficult to trace. Any other? Does that answer your question all right? Okay.
I have a question back here.
Yes.
You talked about Peter Waldo, and I think you said that there's no real evidence that you know of that he was a Sabbath observer.
Yes.
Could you clarify that and perhaps expand upon it? Is there any evidence you know of that he may have kept the Sabbath?
Waldenses, there are documents that the Waldenses have. They merged later with a Protestant body, I think the Presbyterians. This I'm working from memory now, and I don't have the information in front of me. But I couldn't find anything that indicated Peter Waldo was a Sabbath observer. He was a Roman Catholic who was at odds with the church. And they lumped him in with a lot of other heretics. So that's all I can say about him. There's not any evidence that I could find that clearly said he was a Sabbath observer. Any others? You get a break.